Welcome back, Dr. Wes Crenshaw, back here on KLWN every other Wednesday to provide some insight and perspective on a number of different topics. And today you wanted to look at substance abuse.
Yes, and we were just having a really good argument off mic about this, because I think that illustrates how much, how confusing sometimes it is in our society about where kids and substance abuse are. So Annis Boyer is a clinical social worker and also has a certification in certified chemical.
What is it called? Clinical addiction counselor.
Okay. And that's a thing. That's a real thing. And so she has a dual licensure. She can do both psychotherapy and work with people who've had substance abuse or what's also called a behavioral addiction. Sometime we will come in and talk about that. There's the teaser for the summer. Go ahead and tell us what the National Institutes of Health say is the trend, and then I will say what this trend is.
Well, the National Institutes of Health, on a national level, they do a survey with teenagers every year, and they've been doing it since the late 70s. Over the last 5 years, they have shown a decline overall in substance use among teenagers.
And before we go further, can we define what substance is?
Sure, Annis. What's a substance?
Sure.
I mean, is it more than one thing? Are we thinking bigger spectrum?
I know this, but what do they count in that?
They look at alcohol, marijuana, prescription drugs, narcotics.
Is tobacco in there, or is that a separate category?
No, tobacco is in there. Yeah.
Now, that one is definitely on a decline in my experience.
Yes.
So you said over the past 5 years nationally, it's indicating
the general
a decline
trend is that,
among what age range?
High school students.
High school students. Mm-hmm.
And this is NIH, right?
National Institute. And that's a generalization of their findings, but overall,
Yeah. And they've done this since the 70s?
I think 77,
And what they do is go out to schools and have kids take surveys and fill out what their drug use pattern is over the last 30 days and then over the last year, I think.
Yeah, there are a few questions about time span.
And so here's what I think from talking to kids. And people always are like, well, you live in Lawrence. And of course, that's like this unicorn-like unique environment. But I don't agree. I think Lawrence is actually more resembles the coasts in terms of what these trends are than it does the Midwest, just because of the kind of population we have here that is more diverse and comes in from all over the country a lot of times. So here's what I think. It is very clear to me culturally that drinking alcohol amongst the teen group has declined. That has been a surprise to me in the last few years. I know teenagers who will say, yeah, I don't like that. I don't like partying. And they have like this look. Can people see me, how I look? They're like, ooh. And that is really new. Certainly, I grew up in Western Kansas, and most of my friends were big drinkers. Actually, was not. So I was the guy that was the sort of observer of all of these things, like I am now. And so I've seen that. But the use of marijuana at this point, there is no way the NIH is going to convince me that marijuana use has declined. And when you talk to kids after they have filled out the survey, and this has been true for my whole practice because I've always been interested in this, they're sort of, there's the category of people who will probably answer truthfully. They don't care. Maybe they don't have anything to disclose. or they're super. There's also the ones that are like super, I'm going to put down that I smoke because I'm for smoking. I go to 420 in the smoke out,
And then there's people like me who, I don't know if an authority figure's asking me about illegal activity, I may be prone to toe the line.
Yeah, that's exactly where I think these surveys go awry, because kids are not very trusting. When the government comes in and says, I'd like to survey you about your drug use, that's just not what kids want to do. And so that group is like, I'm going to say no because I don't want my parents to find out. Now, of course, I have been a researcher when I was at KU. I know factually that they will not pass a study that has any way of violating the confidentiality. When I say they, the human resource research review board is not going to pass a study that would allow kids to get into trouble. But they don't know that. So that group says, yeah, there's nobody who's dealing drugs in the high schools, which there are quite a few people who are, who's going to write down on a survey, yeah, I deal drugs. Mm-hmm. So there's that group. Then there's the other group that thinks this is funny. I've talked to them, and year in and year out for 25 years, I've talked to these kids, and they giggle when they get this, and they put like, yeah, sniff glue, and put mark down all these things. So I think those data are not reliable. It's the same way with sexuality, that those data, people aren't just going to be like, yeah, I want to share all this, or they're going to overshare. So I've never been a believer in that because it just doesn't reflect a close reality. In the young adult population, is there anything in the study about the like 18 to 24s?
They do have a young adult survey.
Yes. Do they indicate it, if that's gone up or down?
They do, but I didn't look all that up.
Yeah, and I realize in this town we are quite keenly aware of young people's substance use habits, but I have been surprised from when I was in college and even graduate school, and I went to graduate school at KU, the increase in the acceptability of, I don't know that there are more people that drink, but the amount they drink and the length of the week they drink, I think has gone up significantly.
Yeah, because abuse of a substance can be defined too. It could be, how can that be defined?
Abuse?
Yeah, when you abuse a substance, what is that? Does that mean over a long period of time? Does it mean a binge, so to speak?
Right.
I probably have different meanings under abuse.
Sure, there are a couple of different ways of looking at it. But in general, it's if there is risk of harm to yourself or someone else, which could be, binge drinking would have physical consequences. It could have social consequences. If you're drinking and driving, if you're ignoring those negative consequences, then you're probably abusing a substance.
If you have a marital breakup that really mm-hmm. is clearly around substance abuse. And then the second component of that is that you, despite these bad things happening, you cannot or will not stop. And cannot and will not are kind of an interesting idea.
That's kind of a little bit the difference between dependence and abuse. Abuse, you may be able to stop, but are not for one reason or another. Dependence is would require more intensive intervention to help.
They actually raise a good question because they actually changed this in the most recent diagnostic manual that we use for billing purposes to determine what will and won't be covered through diagnosis. And they now use the terms substance use disorder and substance dependency disorder, right? Isn't that how they...
No, it's just a substance use disorder and it's mild, moderate, or severe.
Oh, so there's no dependency.
No.
I don't diagnose this very much, but the big difference is it's now substance use disorder, and so they're looking at it as on a continuum of moderate to bad, and the lower level of that is not hard to achieve. It means and to have a disorder always means that you're impaired. There's something that is worse about this than the average person. So if you're sad, in the case of depression, if you're sad, that's not depression. If you can't get out of bed and go to work and whatever, that's impairment. That's a disorder. Mm-hmm. Same as substance abuse. Yeah.
Dr. Wes Crenshaw is my guest on New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Depend on it, along with a guest from his office, Annis Boyer. We're talking about the topic of substance abuse, looking at a national study on high school students in particular, and looking at the topics of substance abuse.
And so then the golden question, and Annis is going to answer this for everyone definitively with no question. She's going to, here's the question that's always hard for a parent or even a young person to figure out, is when does recreational substance use move from recreational to problematic? And how do people observe that and understand it? So, Annis, definitively answer that.
Okay, I'll give you my definitive answer, and then I'll tell you where to buy my book.
Yeah, that's a good idea. You need a book.
Well, I think it's not an easy thing to answer, and it's very context dependent. From a professional standpoint, anyone who is using illegally is using in a hazardous way, and so you would want to intervene in some way just because of the legal aspect. There's also the aspect of if you're an adolescent and you're using substances, you are still, your brain is still developing, there are still potential consequences for your future. So it, any adolescent use is worth addressing at some level. We know that protective factors would be really strong parental relationships and consistent rules around that. So if those are in place and a child is still using and kind of bucking those systems, then that's an indication that there's a bigger problem, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And it's, I think, I don't know what your experience has been, but I am surprised over the last 20 years that we have gone from a society, not just in Lawrence, but I think nationally, where there was an intense focus on youth substance abuse. And I'm going to count youth as 13 to 24, even though some of those people are legal. But there was this really serious concern, partly because of brain development. Brains aren't finished until you're 25. And partly just because, I know this is a shocker to everyone listening, but kids aren't always making the best choices and, you know, judging things correctly. I do have a lot of respect for kids. I think they are a mighty smart bunch these days, but they are by their definition going to take some risks the rest of us wouldn't find acceptable.
Right.
So that's why there was a big emphasis on that. And that amongst parents and society has gradually moved to where there's a much greater tolerance for substance use and abuse. And a lot fewer rules in many homes laid down to just say no. I can't believe I just uttered the sentence, just say no.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the D.A.R.E. program when I was a kid.
Right. Yeah, and speaking of which, interestingly enough, the D.A.R.E. program has been essentially a failure because what it really did was equate drug use with, say, marijuana and cocaine or just all the same thing. Well, kids caught on very early in that process that this just isn't true in terms of their impact on a person immediate and long term. And so they just discounted everything. And a lot of kids saw D.A.R.E. as a great education on how to use drugs safely. Mm-hmm. So that those kind of things, it's been a real trick to try to really emphasize the serious consequences of substance abuse and not make kids think, oh my gosh, look at the hysterical adults, you know, moralizing and lecturing to us. It's tricky.
I think that's a little bit why it feels like we've kind of loosened the reins a bit, because I think we have found that sort of hard line, it's all evils, just stay away, hasn't been helpful. So we found that opening a conversation with kids and helping them understand what might happen, what the consequences may be, has been more useful. But it means that, you know, sometimes we're willing to talk about it, and that's a hard thing to do, and it's a hard line to walk in the middle there.
Yeah.
You talk about opening up the conversation. You mentioned another word earlier about intervening, and I imagine there's different levels of intervening. Mm-hmm. It could start with a conversation, or it could be more immediate or more urgent. How would you describe like intervening?
I think Annis is right on the money about the problem of the hard line. You know, I was saying to my wife about a different issue this morning that schools have gone back and forth between zero tolerance and too much tolerance.
Right.
There's case by case basis requires you to study the situation and understand it. The same is true with substance abuse, and so what I always talk about in this situation is that parents should have internal expectations and external expectations. And it's fine to say, we do not tolerate you using marijuana, and we are going to act to stop that, because that's a popular one now. Or even more seriously, it's fine to say, we will not tolerate you using prescription drugs, which is a big old problem, both stimulants and like OxyContin, painkillers, narcotics. We're not going to tolerate that, and we're going to act to stop you. Then to have your internal expectation be, we know there's going to be some experimentation and that these things are available, and so we're not going to lose it when something like this happens and do a bunch of really excessive responses, but we're going to act. And it's okay to have different internal and external expectations. You can have more intolerance externally than internally.
Yeah, and I agree. And to address your question about kind of level of intervention, there are different levels of treatment interventions. And so I think parents, if you've set, made some expectations and set clear rules and find that that's not working and find that it's kind of feels like it's getting out of control, then there are professionals who can sit down and talk with the teenager, find out what the severity of the problem is, and then make some decisions about what the best intervention might be. But it can go from, you know, an occasional therapy appointment all the way to residential treatment. And there are a lot of things in between.
Yeah.
Do the parents usually initiate with professionals such as yourself first, or does it initiation with the child first?
When things that aren't substance abuse, issues that aren't substance abuse, it is about as common now for kids to want to initiate as it is for the adult. In the last, I had a bit of an opening in my schedule. Now that I have more staff, I actually can take some clients. And I actually have, in the last month or two, taken some new cases. And most of them were initiated by the teenagers. In the world of the substance abuse diagnosis, I think by its definition, that's less common. Mm-hmm. What is your, is that your
No, that's absolutely too? True. But I think it makes sense. Teenagers are generally not seeing it as a problem yet. Adults will. They're experiencing the consequences, but early on in the process, yeah, it's usually the adults who are concerned about the teen's behavior.
And then that starts up a conversation that is more like the substance abuse conversation, where the parent is saying, I see this as a really big problem. And invariably, the kid is going to come back and say, no, it's not. Mm. Whereas nowadays, if you go to your kid and say, you know, I think you're really depressed, you just seem to be really changed. Most kids, particularly girls, but even guys, will say, yes, I need help. That's not stigmatized as much as it has been in the past. But boy, the idea that you have a drug or alcohol problem, not a popular view. Right. In this.
Well, and I think we have to be careful about your question about when is it a problem, when is it not.
Right.
The fact that a kid has been experimenting may not mean that it's a problem yet, but it's certainly something worth talking about and talking about how it might become a problem.
Yeah.
And kids are, I mean, they're smart. They respond to those conversations if we do it in a way that's not labeling them and kind of backing them into that corner.
Yeah. And I mean, it is a tricky thing because we see it both ways. We see families who are over responding to a child's experimentation, and we see families that under respond to a child. And then we see families that have got it right on the mark and they've come in just at the right time. And any of those things are possible. And it's a lot easier, I think, to hear your kids say, no, this isn't a problem. I'm not going to do it again or whatever. And be like, okay, good. We got through that. It's going to be fine now. And that might be true and it might not be. You have to, again, say, okay, I'm glad we got through this, and internally realize I'm probably going to fly over this territory again.
Yeah, I think the old trust but verify is a pretty good...
It is. I absolutely agree. I always say teens are never trustworthy. and I know this because for 25 years, I've asked kids the question, do you think teens are trustworthy? And only one ever, literally one person said to me, well, yeah, of course you can't. That's like wrong. And she made this impassioned case to me that I was judging people before even knowing. And so she came back to from college after being a teenager. And I said, what was up with that when you were telling me how teens were trustworthy? And she goes, oh, I just lied about that. they're not built to be trustworthy. And so that conversation shouldn't even happen. Kids will say, don't you trust me? And the parent feels guilty. And the parent says, I can't trust you. And the kid feels bad. Just don't even have that conversation. Trust and verify, verify, verify.
Dr. Wes Crenshaw and Annis Boyer, our guests on New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Depend on it. We have just about 2 minutes left. Any final thoughts and takeaways from this conversation?
Well, one of the things that Annis does that is new for us, because I just recognized we had to deal more actively with this, so she can interview somebody and help parents know where the kid is on the continuum of, you know, interesting experimenter person or, you know, wildly overusing substances. And that takes a little doing. It may not just be one session, but it won't be a lot before she can come up with a pretty good estimate of that. And we're not doing primary substance abuse. We're doing the more common situation where somebody has issues, mental health issues, and they are complicated by substance abuse.
Right. The primary substance abuse treatment is not our bailiwick, but certainly we're well educated and informed about it and can help parents and kids have conversations about it and help them make decisions.
And we can support other treatments too. And we can do, one of the big things I had meant to mention that is very helpful is if people do ultimately end up in residential treatment, that's expensive. And the primary predictor of whether it will help in the long run is aftercare, is getting people connected after they've been in, a facility, because otherwise it's probably not going to stick. That's very clear in the literature.
Dr. Wes Crenshaw, thank you for your information. Annis Poyer, thank you as well for your contribution and your insight today. How can people learn more about what the both of you do and learn more about your topics and your conversations?
You can go to drwest.com, which is dr-west.com, and there's a click through now to our blog that we are adding to every week. The shows we do here will appear on there here in the near future. And one of these days, Annis will actually have her blog posting up, and I'm looking forward to reading it, Annis.
And listening. Welcome to the podcast world.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, you're now in. We can now convert these to podcast
form. It's pretty cool.
On KLWN. Well, thank you, and we'll see you in a couple weeks, Dr. West.
That'll be three. I think I have to go to Jamaica. I know that's painful to have to do. So,
all right.
See you in three.
Thank you.
Take care.
This is New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Depend on it.